Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Baltimore, Maryland, and earned a degree in economics from Georgetown University. Following his dream, he became a football coach for the Cleveland Browns and later the Baltimore Ravens. From 1999 to 2008, he was the defensive coordinator of the Tennessee Titans. He is beginning his fifth season as the head coach of the Detroit Lions. His name, Jim Schwartz, and we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to the head coach of the Detroit Lions, Jim Schwartz. Jim, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Oh, it's an honor to be here, Jack.
Can we start by talking about your childhood in Baltimore and your mom and your dad?
I grew up in Baltimore, one of nine kids. My dad was a cop. My mom was a stay-at-home mom before there was such thing as a stay-at-home mom. You know, probably the biggest influence of my life was my mother, who passed away in 1994. You know, my second home as a kid was the public library. Number one, because they had air conditioning, and hot, humid Baltimore summers we didn't. And but just developing a love for reading. My mom always had a baby on one hip and a book on the other. And now, being a father of three kids, I understand how difficult it is to raise three children. I don't know how my mom did it on a policeman's salary when she was raising nine. But you know, I grew up in a very loving home. And have worked hard to try to honor the memory of my mother through my professional life and my personal life.
Where did you fall in the pecking order?
I was the second oldest. My older sister is 2 years older, was adopted because the doctors told my mom that she couldn't have children. And they developed some sort of drug that allowed her to get to term, and she went and had eight children after she'd adopted my older sister.
What's the biggest thing you learned from Mom, Jim, and what's the biggest thing you learned from Dad?
Well, my dad, it was work ethic. My dad was a cop, and he worked his eight-hour beat, and then he came and worked on the house the rest of the time. We had an old Victorian house, probably built turn of the century. And everything needed to be fixed on it. And he basically remodeled it all himself. We never sent a car to the mechanic. My dad did it. And he didn't have any expertise. He just, you know, he just did it. We didn't have money to send a car to the mechanic or paint the house or do anything else. So work ethic, for sure, my dad. And probably a love of learning from my mom. You know, whenever I got summer reading lists, my mom probably went through it before I did. Whenever I had to, you know, write a paper for school, my mom was the one that was typing it. You know, those kind of things. She was just, you know, fascinated by learning, loved to read. And that definitely rubbed off on me.
Mr. Tiger, L. Kaline, grew up in Baltimore as well. He was one of your heroes, along with Cal Ripken. Talk a little bit about Kaline and Ripken.
Well, I grew up, you know, in the 70s in Baltimore. And, you know, the era of Baltimore baseball then was Brooks Robinson and Jim Palmer, Boog Powell, guys like that. But Al Kaline was a native son of Baltimore. You know, Brooks Robinson's from Arkansas. And where I worked in high school, I actually parked at the high school that Al Kaline went to high school at, Southern High School. And the men that I worked with were all in their 50s at the time. Al Kaline was a bigger hero to them than Brooks Robinson or, you know, or Jim Palmer or anything else, because he was one of them. And I only have one autograph photo in my office, and it's of myself and Al Kaline. Just a prince of a man, a true gentleman. And I'm proud to call Baltimore my hometown, you know, because of Al Kaline. You know, just a fascinating story. Never played in the minor leagues, right to the major leagues. And, You know, just that wasn't by accident. Very talented guy, but also a very hardworking and humble guy also.
And a very great golfer to this day.
Yeah, I've heard that. I haven't had a chance to be out with him. It doesn't surprise me. You shake hands with Al Kaline. His hand, you know, he's in his 70s now. His hand still wraps completely around your hand. And you mentioned Cal Ripken, too. You know, as an early adult is when Cal Ripken made his debut in Baltimore. I think he made his debut when I was 16 or 17 years old. And what greater inspiration than a guy that showed up for work every day, never missed a game, you know, hardly ever missed an inning in any of the games that he played. You know, in a working class town like Baltimore, very similar to Detroit, a very blue collar town. You know, what greater hero for the city than a ball player like Cal Ripken?
Coach Schwartz, where did you get your love for football?
Well, when I was a kid, I played every sport, but I never identified with the great players. I always identified more with the coaches. I don't know why. Maybe it was self-awareness. I knew I wasn't that good of an athlete. I played football in college, but it was Division III. It was a good level for me. I was always interested in the strategy of the game. Identified more probably with Earl Weaver and football coaches, baseball managers, basketball coaches. Those were the guys that I looked up to probably more than the great players.
How did you ever get into coaching in football?
Yeah, that's sort of a long story. Never really thought of it as a career path. You know, as every kid, you go through 6 million different things, which you want to be an astronaut, a doctor, a lawyer, you know, you name it. I went to Georgetown University, and I was on a path probably that a lot of my teammates, schoolmates were. Ended up on Wall Street, getting in the financial world. But I think it was a junior in college, that one of my old roommates who had graduated a year before had come back to Georgetown during a homecoming weekend, and he had a few adult beverages one night, and it was probably late. It was 2-3 in the morning, and he was very, very successful first year on Wall Street. Very successful, making a lot of money, but also working a lot of hours and sort of, you know, really grinding it out. And he started weeping. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. He talked about how he hated going to work every day. Didn't have time to enjoy anything that he had done, and wish he could just quit and teach high school somewhere. And it was probably the first time that I ever really thought about coaching as a career, because I said, you know, if I'm going to work 80 hours a week, which what he worked, which is funny because it doesn't even approach our hours, we're about 100 hours a week. I said, if I'm going to work 80 hours a week, I'm going to find something that I really like to do. Well, nobody's going to pay me to read books, and nobody's going to, you know, pay me to work out. Those are the only other things I really enjoyed. Nobody's going to pay to hear me sing or play any music. But football was a love that I had. I played in college. I probably spent more time preparing for football, training, weightlifting, studying the game than anything else. And I started looking around and said, how can I make a career of coaching? And at the time, I thought that I'd end up as a faculty member of a small college somewhere and be a professor / football coach. And that was the path that I originally started to take. I wanted to get a doctorate in economics and coach at a small Division III school where I played at. But my path sort of went a lot of different ways. And you know, I aspired to compete against the best and ended up in the NFL. But it was a little bit by accident. I mean, I never really set out to be a football coach. I was very fortunate along the way to have some people give me some guidance along the way, but it wasn't a lifelong dream. It was something that was more of an interest. And I can honestly say there's a lot of times that I'd like to have an hour extra sleep or something like that, but I've never not wanted to go into work. You know, I've been, you know, it's about 20 years in the NFL for me and 4 years in college before that. Never had one incident where I said, man, I have to go to work today. I've always liked to go to work, and I think that's the beauty. You can't work 100 hours a week if you don't like what you do.
We're talking to Jim Schwartz, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula. and we're with Coach Jim Schwartz, who became a coach under Bill Belichick in 1993 with the Cleveland Browns. Jim, what was the biggest thing you learned from Belichick?
I don't know if everything would suffice. I coached in college for 4 years before that. I coached at University of Maryland, University of Minnesota, North Carolina Central, and Colgate. And I was young. I had no bills. I had a crappy old car. And I wanted to get into the NFL. And for a guy that was 26 years old, there was really no avenue for you in the NFL. But the Cleveland Browns had an unpaid internship, which I jumped at. You know, ran up credit card bills for a year. And I like to tell people I got my PhD in footballology from Bill Belichick, because Bill's a coach, but he's also he's basically a general manager. He's a personnel guy. There was nothing that touched a football team that wasn't important to him. Definitely the biggest learning experience of my career, and a great time for me. I was single. You can work 18 hours a day, just go home and sleep and come back and have nothing else to do and do that 350 days a year or whatever it was. We took 2 weeks vacation. I don't know if I'd be where I am in my career without that experience in Cleveland.
Then you go to the Titans. Coach Jeff Fisher, what did you learn from Jeff Fisher?
Well, I'd spent a lot of time in my career being at the right place at the wrong time, or the wrong place at the right time, or the wrong place at the wrong time. But it was the first time in my career that I was ever in the right place at the right time. I got there, during our Super Bowl run, right before our Super Bowl run in 1999. We led training camp. The headline in the paper was from our owner that said, "This year playoffs are pink slips." I just got married and moved my wife to Nashville, and that's the headline in the paper the night before training camp. But we went to the Super Bowl. Jeff was very resilient. Jeff, he was a very steady hand on a ship. Never got too high when you won. Never got too low when you lost. He never lost confidence in his system and what he did. And that persevered. You look at his longevity. It's hard to have longevity if you're changing course every year and every other year. Jeff was very confident, very steady hand on that franchise, and guided them through a lot of wins.
Speaking of right place at the wrong time or wrong place at the right time, the Lions in 2008 were 0-16. I believe the worst record ever in the history of the NFL. And in January of 2009, Mr. Ford and Bill Ford hire you. What'd they tell you?
Well, it's not so much what they needed to tell me. I talked to a lot of people that worked in the organization, and they all had very good things to say about the Ford family and the way that the way they ran the club. But also, just looking from the outside in, I knew the player like Calvin Johnson they had. There was a tremendous opportunity with the first pick overall. It's hard to turn a franchise around without a quarterback. There was a couple quarterbacks available, but we knew that there would be a quarterback available there. We also had an extra first-round pick. We had some cap room. It's a great football town. I've talked to a lot of head coaches in the NFL, and they say that there's a couple things they looked for. That's ownership, stability in ownership, passionate fans, and the opportunity to improve a franchise, meaning salary cap space, draft picks, things like that. And Detroit had all three of those.
You get hired. The first meeting you had with your squad, coming off that 0-16 season, what was the message you tried to get across to that squad?
I don't know that I really had a message. It was more about just the way we were going to do things. There was different things that, we try not to get too far ahead of ourselves. We try to not look too far behind, sort of stay in the present and, just sort of preach that to them and, different ways that we would handle just the schedule and things like that. But, there was no inspirational speech or anything like that. A lot of that stuff is overblown in the NFL. These guys need a good structure of a program in which to operate. I laid out how we were going to operate and let them go to work, and that was pretty much about it.
What talk about the culture that you've created these last 4+ years with the Detroit Lions?
I think the number one thing that we try to preach is staying in the present. Buck Showalter's the manager of the Orioles, and he says that an awful lot. I got the chance to spend some time with him last summer. And, you know, he talks about what you can control, what you can't control. You know, there's a lot of things that we can't control as coaches. You can't control injuries. And, you know, there's some things that you can't control, and there's some things that you can. But also just, you know, a work ethic that goes along with that. Detroit's a blue-collar town, and we wanted the Lions to have that same sort of work ethic, that same mentality, and have a team that the city could be proud of. And I think that's the thing that I'm most proud of with the Lions is the work ethic that all those guys display. We have some of the best players in the history of the National Football League. You know, a guy like Calvin Johnson has, you know, records. Broke Jerry Rice's record last year. An incredibly hard-working guy. If anything, as a coach, a lot of times I have to say whoa rather than giddy up to a guy like Calvin Johnson. And, you know, when that happens, the leadership of your team, when your best players are also your hardest-working guys, it makes it easy to preach that message because the other guys, you know, they see the success that a Calvin Johnson and some of the other guys that we have, they see the success they have and they want to follow.
After your first mini camp in June of 2009, you took a few rookies. Matthew Stafford, Louis Delmas, Brendan Pettigrew, and you took them to an unannounced visit to the Ford Dearborn Assembly Plant. And you had them there for 2 hours. They signed autographs, took photos, passed out Lions hats, etc. Why did you do that, Jim Schwartz?
Well, first of all, I wanted to see the Rouge. To this day, I still have a 1994 F-150. It has 220,000 miles on it. Now it's sort of semi-retired. It only gets driven for a month before training camp each year. I keep it on the property in Maryland. But I have a lot of respect for the Ford Motor Company and the people that built that car and built something that could last that long. And I don't know if I could have survived in some of my stops, you know, without having a reliable older car. So that was it. But, you know, a lot of times as professional athletes, you know, these guys get signed, they sign a big contract, you know, they get a nice apartment, a condo, a house somewhere, and they live a little bit in a cocoon, and coaches can be the same way. I wanted those guys to get a feel for who their fans were, who were the people that were coming to the games, and what made this city what it was, what it is. And, you know, who they were representing when they went on the field. So, you know, we didn't tell anybody in the media we were going. Barely anybody at Ford knew that we were going. But I thought it was an interesting, you know, when you have a draft a player like Matt Stafford, drafting him number one, he's going to be the face of the franchise, it's important for him to right away get a feel for who the fans were in this city and how passionate they were about the team.
Who are the fans? The Detroit Lions fans.
We have an incredibly passionate fan base. And no matter where I am in the country, there's a Detroit Lions fan. You know, I said I spend a month before training camp in Maryland where I grew up. And, you know, there's not a time that we're with the kids getting ice cream and there's not a guy with a Detroit Lions cap on in front of us or anywhere around the country. And I think that that's number one. It's a very passionate they're not fair weather fans. they've persevered through a lot because they're true football fans. This is a great football town. It's a great state for football. And like I mentioned before, it's a blue collar town. This is a hardworking team or hardworking city that appreciates hardworking players. And you know, I think that you can't mention Detroit without saying that. And there's very few cities in the world that can support four major sports the way that Detroit does. To support the Tigers the way they do and the Lions the way they do and the Red Wings and the Pistons the way they do. You know, there's not many cities in the world that can say that.
We're talking to Coach Jim Schwartz. When we come back, we'll ask him about the upcoming season. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Coach Jim Schwartz. Coach, September 8th, 1 p.m. at home, Minnesota Vikings. Do you know the entire schedule?
I know we open with the Vikings. You know, we mentioned before about the immediacy and keeping your eyes on what is most important. And I've coached in college before, and, you know, there's those red letter games, you know, Michigan, Ohio State, or, you know, UCLA, Notre Dame, or USC in Notre Dame, one of those. And, you know, you always know when that game's coming up. The fans look forward to it. And I think our fans, people in the media, get our schedule, and they right away mark some games. And, you know, we sort of take a lot more game by game. There's a cliche, probably a well-worn cliche of taking it one week at a time. The reason that cliche has lasted so long is because it's true. That's the only thing you can do. And, you know, when it's the off season, you can't play the first game. You have to just handle the off season. When it's mini camp, you know, you can't play the first game. You can't play the Super Bowl in May. You have to worry about what's directly in front of you. Same thing with training camp. You know, your goal for training camp is to have a good day each day. And if you can build those days on top of each other, then you'll be ready for the opener. It's great to be opening at home in Ford Field. That's something that we haven't been able to do in the last few years. You know, and I think that's our fans deserve that, and it'll be nice to have that opener there.
Talk to us, Jim Schwartz, about the workout and study routine of a professional football player today.
It's an intense thing. It's very difficult mentally to play in the NFL. And I'm not just talking about being mentally tough and handling adversity and, you know, playing with pain and things like that. I'm talking about the grind that goes on to the season. You only play once a week. So the preparation is the only thing that you can do the other days. And the game is incredibly complex. It's gotten more and more complex every single year. And there's very few people that aren't very smart playing in the NFL. Our players usually get to the office anywhere between 6 and 7. They'll have breakfast. They'll get treatment. You know, they might lift weights early in the morning if they don't lift in the afternoon. We have meetings from 7:30 until about 11:15. We practice at 11:15, practice for 2 hours. We'll come off the practice field, have lunch. The guys that didn't lift in the morning will lift in the afternoon. We'll come back and we'll have more meetings. And they're generally gone by about 5 o'clock or so, but most of them take work home with them. You know, it's the beauty of technology now. You know, they can watch game film on an iPad. They can watch at home. They don't have to be at the office to be able to access a lot of that stuff. They do it full-time. You know, there's no off-season jobs for most of these guys. There's too much at stake in what they have to do. They all take it very seriously. And, you know, you have to have some perseverance to be able to make it through a season. You have to be able to concentrate for long periods of time. So guys that are successful are able to do those things.
I quote you now, quote, "I sell myself to 53 millionaires each day during the season." How do you do that, Jim Schwartz?
A little bit like I talked about with Jeff Fisher. You have to have confidence in what you're preaching. You have to believe what you're saying. You can't try to sell them something that your heart isn't into. If you show a passion for what you're doing, if you're prepared, players can deal with a lot of different kind of coaches. There's some coaches that are very loud, some coaches that you rarely hear a word from. You know, some great coaches with different styles. You know, players can take all of it if they know that you can help them succeed. And I think that's the biggest thing is putting a good plan together. It might not be the best thing for them personally, but if it's the best thing for the team, then they'll all believe in it. And you have to show passion for it, and you have to be consistent from week to week. Again, there's no light teams on our schedule. We don't play any 1AA teams. We don't have any homecoming opponents or anything like that. Every game is a challenge, and you have to have consistency from week to week. They don't want a coach that's up one week, that's down one week, that prepares differently each week of the season.
Speaking of millionaire players, back on July 10th, it was announced that Matt Stafford is signing a 3-year extension where that he had $23.5 million left on the existing, and we added another $53 million. Talk to us about Matt Stafford.
Yeah, that's good work if you can get it, isn't it? You know, Matt, like I mentioned before I even took the Detroit job, there were some things that I knew from talking to people in the league, and that was about the fans of the Lions and also about the ownership and the structure of the team. But the availability of a number one pick and also the opportunity to, or the opportunity of a number one pick and the availability of a player like Matt Stafford. We drafted Matt, and he had just turned 21. You know, Matt's still not 26 years old yet. And, you know, he's thrown for almost 5,000 yards two times, thrown for 5,000 once and almost 5,000 again. He's led a team to the playoffs. He's also had the perspective of being injured and missing seasons with injury and things like that. You know, when you're a quarterback, you're probably going to get too much praise and also accept too much of the blame. Just goes with the job. So with Matt, his physical skills were important, but his personality, his leadership, his personal character was probably more important in the evaluation of him and the decision to draft him. You know, he's a guy that, you know, it doesn't get too high, doesn't get too low. He's very consistent from week to week. He's very, very smart. You know, and Detroit is in very good hands with a quarterback like Matt Stafford.
A quote from Matt Stafford. "That guy works harder than anybody I know," and he was referring to Megatron, Calvin Johnson. Talk to us about Megatron.
Yeah, 6'5", 240 pounds, breaks about every, I don't know what the word is, every quality or every limiting quality of players that you could think. You could never think a guy that big could run that fast, could be so silky smooth, but very, very humble. You know, he broke Jerry Rice's all-time NFL record last year in a year that we lost just about every other wide receiver that was on the roster. So he was doubled on just about every play and still broke the record. Incredibly humble, a very hard-working guy. You know, a lot of wide receivers have diva personalities. I think it's pretty common with the position. And Calvin's personality couldn't be any more opposite of that. You know, he's whatever's best for the team, he's willing to do. If it means catching 20 balls, he'd do it. If it means a game that he catches two balls, as long as the team wins, that's the only thing that he really concerns himself with. You know, incredibly well respected, not just for his physical talent, but because how hard he works in practice. Like I said before, so many times I have to say whoa rather than giddy up with him. He dives for balls in practice. He dives for balls in pregame warmups. And you want to tell him, hey, Calvin, don't dive for a ball in pregame warmups. But, you know, that's just who he is. And you can't take that out of him, and you just need to embrace it. And I think all the other players respect that.
We're talking to Coach Jim Schwartz, and I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to the head coach of the Detroit Lions, Jim Schwartz, who's starting his fifth season in a couple of weeks, 1 o'clock at home against the Vikings. Jim, what do all great coaches have in common?
Like I said before, there's a lot of different personalities when you talk about the great coaches. Guys like Tom Landry, I don't know that you ever probably heard him raise his voice. Other guys like Mike Ditka, you know, probably raise his voice. You know, Vince Lombardi, those guys, you know, were guys that part of their persona was, you know, being loud and being gruff. You know, I think all of them had a passion for what they did, and it wasn't work for them. You know, they enjoyed the game. They enjoyed the strategy of the game. They enjoyed the competition. They had an incredible competitive nature. And, you know, I don't think anybody can make it through any business if they're not organized. I think all those guys in their own different way were all organized, and they were all true to themselves. You know, I think, like I said before, players will respond to coaches as long as they don't think that you're playing an act. You know, if you're a quiet guy and you're trying to be loud, players will see right through that. I think all those guys that are great coaches, they all had a unique personality, and they all accepted that personality, and that's what they coached with.
Bear Bryant, and I quote him, "If anything goes bad, I did it. If anything goes semi-good, we did it. If anything goes really good, then you did it. That's all it takes to get people to win football games for you."
Oh, there's no question. There's no question. We talked a little bit before about quarterbacks. And the great quarterbacks never hang one of their offensive players out to dry. They won't blame a sack on the left tackle. They might say, yeah, you know, he got beat, but I should have got rid of the ball quicker. I should have stepped up right there. Or, you know, an incomplete pass. They'll say, I didn't make a good enough pass. That ball was delivered late. Coaches are the same way. You know, there's a lot of similarities between quarterbacks and coaches. Yeah, you definitely deflect credit. And all the blame is going to come. Whether you accept it or not, all the blame is going to come. And you have to be willing to live with that. You have to have a thick enough skin that doesn't change you and that doesn't make you react to criticism. You know, everybody knows it's easy to see if the quarterback's successful. It's easy to see if the kicker is successful. It's hard for the average football fan to look at the right guard and see if he was successful on a play. It's hard to look at, you know, a linebacker on a particular play and see if he was successful. But you know, I think very few people think they can be Megatron. They know they're not 6'5" and 240 pounds and run 4.3, but they all think they can be the coach. And if you don't embrace that kind of scrutiny, that kind of criticism, you're not going to be successful.
Bum Phillips once said, they asked him about Don Shula, and he said, well, he's the only guy that can take Theron on Sunday and beat Usson, and then on Thursday take Usson and beat Theron. What made Shula so good?
You know, he was a small college player also, went to John Carroll University in Cleveland. He didn't go to Ohio State, he went to John Carroll. Played both ways early in his Baltimore Colt career. Became a coach fairly young. I don't know if he had an injury in his career or something like that, but you know, I think that there is something to that. They're good coaches. Get the best out of players. I know guys that played for Don Shula, and you know, they talked about his consistency. He didn't change when they were undefeated, and he didn't change throughout his career. It's one of the things he got some criticism for late in his career is being sort of set in his ways and things like that. But when it served him so well through the course of his career, it's hard to criticize him for doing that. But I think any great point guard, any great quarterback, any great coach, you know, there's that commonality of making the other guys around you better. And I think that's probably what they were talking about with Don Shula.
You look at the coaching tree under Bill Walsh. Amazing. Talk to us about Bill Walsh.
You know, I knew people that worked for Bill Walsh, but I never had any direct contact with him. I think the thing that there was a tremendous amount of, I don't know what the word is, trying to prove people wrong. Bill Walsh didn't advance early in his career. He was stuck behind and, you know, really didn't become a head coach until later in life. And he was incredibly driven, and this comes from people that worked for him, he was incredibly driven to sort of prove that wrong. He was incredibly competitive that way. An innovator of the game, you know, it's one of the most common terms in the NFL is West Coast offense. Well, there's 32 teams in the NFL. All 32 employ some version of the West Coast offense. I mean, that's the influence that he had in the game. It wasn't a gimmick offense that lasted a couple years, maybe like the Wildcat. The Wildcat was very successful for a year, and then defensive coaches got a hold of it and, you know, did a good job of silencing it, so to speak. But nobody's really been able to silence the West Coast offense. You know, it was developed in the early 80s, and, you know, it was still being used today. I think that's all that needs to be said. He did a great job of not just coaching a team. He also developed coaches, and you know, he worked hard to prepare those guys for head coaching jobs and for advancement, and supported them when they wanted to go out and do that. Another guy that did that was Lou Holtz at Notre Dame. Mm-hmm. A lot of head coaches came from Notre Dame, and that wasn't by accident.
Speaking of Holtz, the other day I heard him say that discipline is not something you do to a person. Discipline is something you do for a person.
Well, there's probably a lot of high school coaches that agree with that also. You know, I mean, it's the most important thing in any business or any sport is doing the right thing at the right time. You know, at the critical time, being able to respond. You know, so I think that there you have to be able to prepare for that situation, and that preparation isn't always easy. You know, anybody that's run a marathon knows that the preparation is not easy. But if you're going to make 26 miles, there's going to be some discipline into you doing it every single day. And some people aren't motivated to do that. So sometimes it takes a coach to help them through that.
Speaking of high school coaches, as our time winds down tonight, Coach Schwartz, what advice would you give to our young listeners?
You know, I think anytime I speak to kids, any young adult, or, you know, kids, I always just try to tell them that the most important thing for life is finding something they have a passion for and trying to do that for a living. You know, like I said, that way you never work a day in your life. I don't have a very good work ethic. I work 100 hours a week, but I don't have a very good work ethic. You can look at the inside of my car. It needs a good vacuum, and I don't have time or, you know, the sort of discipline to do that. But I have the discipline to work 100 hours a week because I like what I do. And I think that's the secret is, you know, find something that they're passionate about. Music, sports, art, you know, history, whatever it is. And try to make a living doing that. And if they can do that, they're set for a lifetime of happiness.
Coach Schwartz, as this fifth season begins, as the head coach of the Lions, we wish you the best.
Thank you.
And keep up the passion and keep those motivated fans coming.
Hey, I love the theme of anything is possible. It's a great theme for any football team, and I think we'll carry that through this year.
God bless. Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week because with God, anything is possible. Spahome.